Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
From ARK Invest, this is FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton. With us today, we have our fearless leader, CEO, CIO, Kathy Wood. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Brett.
Hi. And then Tom Lee, who's co-founder of Fundstrat Global Advisors, but also the chairman of Bitmain Immersion Technologies, the digital asset treasury company that holds, I think, the largest corporate holder of Ethereum in the world. Is that right? Could that be?
Yes.
Tom, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for doing this, Tom. This will be fun.
Our pleasure. Tell us, Tom, okay, the calendar is turning, the world is changing, and you decide to step in and supercharge Bitmain Immersion by basically asking it to acquire lots and lots of Ethereum as a digital asset treasury company. What is a DAT? Why Bitmain Immersion? Why Ethereum? What are you doing?
And why now?
Yeah, about 3 months ago, so 12 weeks ago, I became chairman of Bitmain Immersion and led a transformation, as you point out, where the company went from being a small Bitcoin miner to one where it continues to mine Bitcoin on a very small way, but now its primary treasury asset is Ethereum. And in the ensuing 12 weeks, we've become the largest holder of Ethereum in the world. Today, we announced 2.8 million ETH tokens, which is, with the cash on hand, it's about $13.5 billion worth of crypto.
And those of us watching you so carefully as you make these announcements about how much Ether you own, we're also trying to figure out the number of shares you have outstanding so we can understand ETH per share, which I know is a big driver here.
Yes. And we do provide periodic updates on that.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. And but we've done this in a way that has been accretive to Bitmain shareholders, because at the start of this process, there was about $4 of Ethereum per share. That's when the announced transaction happened. And the stock price of Bitmain was $4.50. And on August 27th, which was the last update, so we're due for a new update, the stock had Ethereum per share of $39. So almost a 9 times increase, almost 10 times increase in those 8 weeks. We have since increased it again in the past 4 weeks, but the company is working hard to make sure that every Bitmain share has more Ethereum every day.
One of the questions I have is, our working assumption has been that winner is going to take most here. Is that why you've moved so quickly? And was that your working assumption? Because obviously, the number of DATs out there today has exploded. You set a trend.
Yes, there's, I believe, 70, globally 70 Ethereum DATs. So it's very large space, but it is, as you coined, winner take most. If you look at trading volume, Bitmain trades $2.5 billion per day. And I think increasingly people look at a trading volume as really the critical measure of success for a treasury strategy. It ranks as the 28th most traded stock in America. And combining Bitmain with MicroStrategy, the two of us in total account for 86% of all trading volume of global crypto treasuries. So we are the two institutionally liquid stocks.
before we go on, we really should tip our hat to Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy. Remember how crazy people thought he was for a very long time. And now more and more people are getting it. Why do you think it took so long for the dApp movement to make its way into ETH and Solana?
Well, and if I could insert, why do dApps exist at all? Like, why do we need the whole point? If I went back in time and told, you know, Satoshi, hey, you know, this decentralized tokenized asset is going to live in a corporate shell that people are going to buy on corporate equities, you would be like, what is good? This is totally contrary to the kind of underlying philosophy of the underlying tokens, isn't it? Like, why do these things exist?
Yes and no, Brett. I think that 2025 is showing you that dApps are coming into existence really because the foundations and the crypto community actually need them. But going back to Kathy's question about like why 2025 for Ethereum, the Bitcoin and MicroStrategy's 2020 pivot made a lot of sense because Bitcoin was only 11,000 at that time. And he represented the sole way to get exposure to Bitcoin for any institutional equity manager.
Well, except for GBTC, right? Because we were in GBTC.
Yes, but for a firm like Capital Research or T. Rowe, they're unable to buy a closed-end fund or an ETF or directly own crypto because their mandates require them to own a corporate equity.
I see.
So Overstock was probably the only way someone could buy Bitcoin in the past. And then MicroStrategy came along. So MicroStrategy is almost 2.0 as Bitcoin treasury. What he's done successfully, of course, is really to upscale it so rapidly because he went from having $2 of Bitcoin per share to over $250 per Bitcoin share per MicroStrategy share today. So he has created enormous shareholder returns because his security business, of course, has continued to really muddle along at basically zero growth. In Ethereum, I think the moment is really this year because this is the year that Wall Street and governmental regulations became friendly to think about rebuilding on the blockchain. And part one, of course, was the stablecoins, and stablecoins have really been the breakout hit in crypto. We coined it as the ChatGPT moment for crypto because it has become a breakout product, and it has created two enormous companies, one being Circle, which I know ARK was an anchor investor in the IPO, and the other is Tether. Tether today is raising money at a $500 billion valuation. And roughly 300 employees. That's about $1.7 billion of market value per employee.
Yeah, we featured that. We featured that, Tom, in last year's Big Ideas because we said, oh my goodness, at the time it had 180 employees. We said, you know, there's never been anything like this before. Right.
Yeah.
So you're right.
And so JP Morgan, who just $869 billion has 313,000 employees, or 2.8 million of value per employee. Tether is showing you a crypto native bank is fundamentally vastly more profitable. And that's what I think is happening on smart contract blockchains that are neutral, like Ethereum and Solana. But it really only could have started in 2025.
One of the reasons I think the timing was good is, yes, the regulatory changes, critical. Check the box, first the ETFs in the old administration, but now the, you know, unencumbered deregulation, just, you know, tremendous openness to it. And we were having trouble gaining access to ETH for our ETFs, which are not like mutual funds. They have a little more. They have more degrees of freedom, shall we say. We didn't want to use one of the Ether ETFs because the SEC does not yet allow staking. And we tried to gain access through 3IQ and other Canadian ETFs, which do allow staking. But then we were becoming way too big a percentage of those. And we were also subjecting the funds to the risks of bad income. So the reason I asked you about timing is you came along at the time we were trying to figure this out and provided a solution. So I did want to, I asked for that reason because you really did solve a problem.
Yeah. Well, thank you for also investing in Bitmine. We are, of course, really working for all shareholders. And yes, we appreciate ARK because of the, I think, knowledge transfer, you know, that happens with ARK and their exponential research. And so it's been great to have you in the cap table.
Well, you've got our chief futurist here, and he's now using not the word exponential, but super exponential.
It's true.
to describe opportunities as technologies merge.
Yeah.
But I think Kathy's point is like illustrative of something that I think it's important for people to understand, which is that there is perpetually in crypto assets, there has been a set of investors that have been held off sides, where it's kind of regulatory pressure, kind of like rules that have been written for an old infrastructure and age prevent them from actually getting exposure and access to the underlying assets. And so the importance of digital asset treasuries is they provide basically a wrapper around the tokens that can bring these people on sides. And even though, like, even the ETFs have launched in the US, but from, you know, many advisors still can't, you know, actually cleanly buy the ETFs, even for Bitcoin, forget Ethereum. And so this kind of digital asset treasury company is a mechanism by which you basically take the underlying token and you cloak it in a recognizable, you know, corporate shell that can plug into the existing infrastructure.
Yes. And that's also why I think these treasuries actually play a role in the actual ecosystem, because one, the knowledge base is capital markets, but with transference into the DeFi world, we found a lot of important and useful conversations taking place between Bitmine and the Ethereum Foundation, and even the founders of Ethereum, because we can help bridge this knowledge of like, what is Wall Street looking for? You know, what are the low regulatory or high regulatory and the features that they're looking for on a blockchain or an L2. But we represent a committed group of permanent capital with the governance coming from a mandate from shareholders. And we've been then using that, and we will be using that to help seed the appropriate DeFi and crypto projects, but also the rails that come into Ethereum. And I think another role that we can play is, of course, just helping communicate what Ethereum actually wants to do. I think we found many of the people in the DeFi system, especially when we were at Token 25, says that they felt that Bitmine helped really clean up the narrative of Ethereum and make Ethereum a lot more credible in the minds of institutions. And we've actually found that in our conversations, of course, with actual builders, because we've been meeting with banks that are now trying to understand how to build on top of crypto. And of course, they want to take advantage of, again, our transfer knowledge base. Because remember, the knowledge in the traditional finance world is different about their understanding of crypto and who they can trust and who they can't. Oh, and there's one other thing that we are also providing liquidity, because, you know, we have 2.8 million ETH tokens. And believe it or not, even ETFs that stake need a liquidity backstop. So I think that an entity like Bitmine can also play a role in actually providing contingent liquidity for ETH, even the ETF world.
Can I, and Brett, then I know you have very specific questions, but before we go there, just the high level and to get people to understand your vision here. One of the things you've been saying is you think that the Ethereum network or market cap is going to flip with Bitcoin. Now, Bitcoin is at about, what is it, 2.4 trillion now, somewhere around there. And Ethereum is 540 billion. You think there is a flippening, as they might say. I'd love to hear you talk about it. But just to set this up, anyone who's listening to this podcast knows that we have in 2030 a forecast of the entire crypto asset ecosystem. And of course, we're going to be modifying this with time. We're doing our big ideas work now. But as of our last go at this, you know, the ecosystem, we expect to hit $25 trillion in 2030. The vast majority of that in Bitcoin, mostly because we look at Bitcoin as, you know, a global monetary system, you know, rules based that we've been missing since the U.S. went off the gold exchange standard in 1971. That's a very big idea. It's a technology, obviously, and it is the first of its kind. And we wrote a paper in 2016 on this, first of its kind in a new asset class. So those are three very big ideas. I'd love to hear your thoughts on why ETH or the ecosystem will surpass Bitcoin.
Okay. Well, if I could rewind a little bit to 1971, in our chairman's message last month, we addressed how gold versus Wall Street grew post-1971. So 1971 was when Nixon formally withdrew the U.S. from the gold standard. The immediate beneficiary was there was demand and a market to own gold. And so gold. People would say that was your, you know, first implication. But when what we wrote about and talked about in our message was that in 1971, the dollar became fully synthetic because it was no longer backed by anything. And so there was risk that the world would go off the dollar standard. So in stepped Wall Street to create products to propagate the future of Wall Street, including, and we listed, I think, 14 products that emerged over the next decade, from money market funds to credit to mortgage-backed securities to futures, et cetera. And dollar dominance by the end of that period went from 27% of GDP terms, but to 57% of central bank reserves and 80% of financial transaction quotes. So Wall Street was created products that made the dollar dominant. And the market cap of equities today is $40 trillion compared to $2 trillion for gold. So in other words, gold is 5% of all available assets. And so in 2025, we think everything is now becoming synthetic as we, or tokenized, sorry, not synthetic. So as we move not just dollars onto the blockchain, which is stablecoins, but we'll move stocks and real estate, dollar dominance is going to be the opportunity of Ethereum. So digital gold is Bitcoin. And so in that world, we believe Ethereum could flip Bitcoin, similar to how Wall Street and equities flipped gold post-71. Now, that is just our working theory, because I am still a Bitcoin bull. So I'm very bullish on Bitcoin. And I believe your targets for Bitcoin are actually reachable. So I, you know, we think Bitcoin fair value should at least be 1.5 to 2.1 million. But we can see higher values. But that would, of course, provide upside to a neutral smart contract platform where a lot of Wall Street will innovate of real-world assets.
One of the thoughts here is, you know, Ethereum went from proof of work to proof of stake. Now, in the next 5 years, I mean, we just think about all of the creativity that is going to evolve in the financial markets around Ethereum. We totally agree with you on that. But there will come a time where we're in some kind of crisis, and then we see that the benefits of proof of work relative to proof of stake, because you're bringing in, as you say, you are bringing in a lot of TradFi and a TradFi thinking into the Ethereum world. So just wondering, you know, if a crisis will be a moment of self-reflection and like, all right, is there a real difference between this proof of work world and this proof of stake world?
Yes, there is existential questions that'll emerge on proof of stake, but it's also, I think, going to happen with proof of work, because we know Bitcoin mining, for instance, is becoming concentrated in corporate. In fact, I think this year there was one mining operation that actually had won 6 successive block rewards, which is a high level of concentration. And as you know, as we get closer to 2140, the block reward is going to be so small that it may not provide the economic incentives to actually continue mining, which would represent greater concentration. So I don't know if at that point Bitcoin miners start to wrap Bitcoin to generate yield or other innovations. But proof of stake, you're right, is, you know, because staking is an operational activity in security, if you have people reduce their staking, you weaken the security of the network. I think that's where the dApps are actually helping provide permanent capital. Because collectively, we are more than 3.5% of network. But Sharplink and BitMine both want to get 5% of Ethereum. That's 10% held, and a few others. So if you end up with 15 to 20% permanently staked, that is going to provide, I think, a high level of security, because we will get slashed otherwise if we're not meeting our requirements. So I think right. You have...
I mean, it's almost like there's a useful fiction in decentralization, but there's also useful in having these centralized nodes. As in, I think about your comment about traditional Wall Street wanting to be able to talk to somebody and say, this is what we need the network to be able to do. And if it's purely decentralized, there's nobody to talk to. Mm-hmm. You know, and so then that's a function that BitMine is providing.
That's right.
And
Yeah, we're one of the voices, just as much as the foundation is a voice and the founders are a voice, and then there's the community. So I think we're representing a voice that capital markets can use us as a conduit. And of course, because we want both the network to succeed, and also we want Wall Street to move on to the blockchain. So our incentives are really aligned for helping sort of propel that movement.
If you look at take our forecast for a second, and I know you've laid out an Ethereum number that suggests on the order of $7 trillion in network value for Ethereum, I think. But you know, take 25 trillion as the full bucket and apportion it how you will. Is there a natural percentage of that you think can and should reside in digital asset treasuries versus being kind of held external? And is there like a too much number? Like, how do you have an idea of, like, I know you've at BitMine, you've laid out a 5%, you want to capture 5% of the supply. But is there, like, would you increase that? How do you think about that?
So there's power law at work, which is, you know, there is a level where if an entity owns too much of a network, they actually have a negative effect because they're crowding out innovation. We spoke with a few researchers, including Fundstrat, and then folks like Jeffrey Kendricks at Standard Charter. 10% is actually still an acceptable level, because if you think about even in any competitive world, if someone has 10% of a system, they aren't in control of it. You know, there's, you know, I don't know if you remember the Herschel-Herfindahl HHI index. And if you run that calculation, especially with 70 dApps, and then in DeFi, it's not a concentrated market. It would still be considered highly competitive. So I think up to 12 million Ethereum tokens isn't crowding. And that's double BitMine's target. Besides BitMine, however, as you know, other crypto treasuries have not even been able to secure 1% of ETH. And part of it is that you need the public to provide you the trust through the velocity and trading volume of the stock in order to to get there. So I think that there isn't going to be DATs controlling 50% of the Ethereum network.
Right. But what is it like? You're saying it's okay for a single entity to own 10%, and you could have other DATs like Downstack. So collectively, it could be something like 15 or 20%, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, does that sound?
It's still a TBD because, for instance, you know, Bitmain is now actually, believe it or not, I think the 470th largest company in America in market cap. And if you look at staking, you know, because we'll announce staking, our staking solution very soon, but assuming a 2.79% yield on a pre-tax net income basis, it's like the 800th most profitable company in America.
You say America, Tom, do you think, because we've seen Metaplanet in Japan and Strategy here.
Yes.
Do you think this is a regional phenomenon? Or, I mean, because I've always thought of crypto as a global phenomenon, but because you're introducing TradFi and DeFi, you know, maybe this is a regional phenomenon, do you think?
I think you're right. It will be global because Bitcoin and Ethereum are held globally. And Metaplanet has certainly shown it's super differentiated in Japan. But the dynamic is the same because Bitmain and MicroStrategy will soon be Russell 1000 constituents. MicroStrategy already is. So that opens up to passive index flows because that means now 1,700 large cap managers now have to make a decision on whether to overweight or underweight the 480th largest company in America. And that's why Bitmain, I think, could actually have accelerating flows next year and support.
It's so interesting to watch this because, you know, the idea that indexation is going to be a phenomenon here is mind-blowing to me because, you know, well, when we first started this journey in 2014-15, we were considered raving lunatics. And even within the last few years, they were able to hide behind regulators who were hostile. It's really only now, and you're already, it's 2025, for the first time, index players are going to have to make this, or benchmark sensitive players, I should say, are going to have to make this decision. That's so interesting. It's going to force education into the market, kicking or screaming.
That's right. And then we already have crypto native companies like Circle and Figment and Bullish that are actually highly profitable and in some ways more attractive than the traditional counterpart. And so it is a very different world today than it was when MicroStrategy took the bold step of buying Bitcoin.
You know, I want to pull on kind of like you mentioned, Circle is like a modern bank, or Tether is a modern bank that's much more profitable. And the digital asset treasury companies, I've always had this sense of unease where it's kind of like, okay, here's something that's trading above NAV. So you're able to sell equity above NAV and then buy the underlying. But over time, particularly with competitive pressure, it would seem like there will be a lot of equity issuance that would then pull kind of like the basically NAV, the net asset value back to the underlying equity value.
Well, unless it's winner take most, right?
Well, right. And I'm thinking about kind of like, well, you're kind of like a bank, but a reverse bank, as in your liabilities are long dated and your assets are short dated and you have like a liquid underlying pool of assets, you know, whereas a bank's like lend out, they lend long and borrow short. You're lending short and borrowing long. So it's more stable. And banks will trade it above book value. They trade it above book value when there's like, hey, you know, we can take on more deposits here that we're going to deploy into more assets intelligently. And so then from that framework, it's like, yes, you could trade above book because people are anticipating that you will get flows that will allow you to increase kind of like the Ethereum per share over time.
Yes.
Right?
And also I would say that the passive index flow is why MicroStrategy has held onto it's a portion of its NAV premium.
We don't pay attention to indexes, so I've never thought about this. This is quite illuminating, Tom.
Yeah, imagine this. If you look at the cap table of Bitmain today, maybe there's 10 institutions, but then there's going to be 1,700 that have to decide whether they want to underweight. But equally important, as you know, Ethereum, because it's a smart contract platform, and then the role we're playing within both the community and with the rails, you can see us that we look more like a financial intermediary, which by definition is a bank. And yes, so we should trade at a premium to book value. And there is an ability to add light touch, not the lightly regulated operating businesses that don't consume capital. And the ETH staking, you know, will generate, even just on the current ETH, you know, close to $400 million of pre-tax net income with zero debt on the company.
So, Tom, I have been away from investing in traditional banks for a very long time. What is the multiple to book value? And why would you even put yourself anywhere near their orbit, since this world we're talking about is going to completely disintermediate them, right? I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but you know, is going to be quite disruptive.
Yeah, Kathy, I think I might bookend two companies and then we can put everybody somewhere on the curb. But the two largest banks in the world now are Tether and JP Morgan. And JP Morgan trades at, I believe, over two times tangible book.
Okay.
But they have 330,000 employees, which is their largest expense. And in an AI and blockchain world, they may go down to 20,000 employees. So the JP Morgan likely re-rates in the future towards being a technology stock.
Yeah, no question. This is going to be a little bit like what happened in retail. So Walmart and Costco re-rated as the rest of the industry was being destroyed, right? Or consolidated away, right? That is what we expect to happen. So the other end of the spectrum, so that was JP Morgan.
And as you point out, Costco and Tether, Walmart traded 35 to 50 times forward earnings, which is higher than even NVIDIA's multiple, which I
I know. It's pretty wild.
Now, Tether's tangible book is quite low, and it has a vastly more profitable business because it is very light employee intensive. You know, the employee intensity is low. So if that price to book, let's say, is a exponent, a log function of JP Morgan's 2 to 3 times, which is rising, then that means that crypto treasuries shouldn't trade at 2 times NAV that are involved in the ecosystem. So in other words, the Bitcoin treasuries are designed to be inert. MicroStrategy is an inert holder of Bitcoin, but Bitmain is active and engaged in the Ethereum ecosystem. So it'll trade more like a financial intermediary, but JP Morgan and Tether are the bookends. I think that's why that multiple of the ETH holdings will actually rise over time for the winner take most.
What could disturb the winner take most? Sometimes technologies do, but what could disturb that or knock Bitcoin, Bitmine off the perch? What is there anything that you could see? Because it does happen from time to time, you know, just in technology. We've seen, this is really a long time ago, but Lotus, what did it have, Brett? We've done like 50% of the market or so.
I think it had 60%, and then 60%, it got eaten.
And then it was effectively destroyed and, as you say, eaten by IBM. I think.
By Microsoft.
Microsoft.
I think definitionally, if Ethereum is not the long-term winner, then the company's leverage to Ethereum could trade at a discount to NAV because there is now a liquidity unwind or a discount to the future, which would say that if Ethereum is a dead chain, then all the holders of Ethereum should trade at a discount.
So Solana making a go is a risk out there, but institutions signing on to, you know, the Ethereum network is a big vote of confidence, right?
Yes. If you were to look at where the development is today, especially L2s and announced, even including like Swift building on Linea, Ethereum has already won the discount to the future. Mm-hmm. Because it is 100% uptime network. And I have gotten the clear sense, spending time at Token 24 now with a lot of the Ethereum founders, that they are really listening to make sure they're going to do the upgrades that allow Wall Street to build on Ethereum. So I think it's a change of views.
Yeah. And we also had the privilege of speaking to the Ethereum Foundation, and I was so impressed at sort of their technology mindset. We were talking about AI and robotics and, you know, all of the things that ARK is really interested in. Obviously, they should be, but they are. They're well advanced in terms of their research from what I could tell.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of the rejuvenation of the thinking within Ethereum that I think is helping the community galvanize too. So I think that there is a lot of there to Ethereum being the base where Wall Street is going to build a lot of the future.
Is it concerning to you that we're now back in the land of more layer one blockchains being launched? You know, there's, I think, a Circle announcement. There's kind of like, these individual, call it application layers, that are thinking, actually, we need, you know, a specific level one for us, and think that that's kind of like the strategic angle to go. Does that concern you? Do you think that's going to work?
And what do you think of ARK, the layer one that Circle has put in place for financial institutions?
Well, there's just two observations I make, and then I'll make a broader statement. But as you know, corporate chains are always going to be viewed as someone's fat finger on the scale. And that's just how Wall Street operates anyways. You know, if some bank created a layer one blockchain and they're the oracle, we know that they're tilting that in their favor. And of course, the second is that all blockchains are basically databases, and the security model becomes a question, because it's either a centralized chain, which isn't really a blockchain, or it's got a security model that can be exploited. And we know there's so many high profile hacks that have taken place. And uptime is a third dimension, because as you know, that is one of the prominent features of Ethereum, that its entire history, resilience was an existing feature and has never had any downtime. And I think that that's important when we're thinking about a world of high speed transactions in a 24/7 world. I think a lot of creativity needs to take place on layer ones. And, you know, I mean, to me, as we think about tokenized world and using prediction markets, a lot of that thinking is taking place around building on layer ones and layer twos on Ethereum. But a broader statement I'd make is, I don't think one blockchain can hold the entire financial system anyways, because let's say your $27 trillion is correct, and I believe it is even conservative, because today global GDP is $80 trillion. And we know GDP is an imperfect measurement because it only measures final sales. So let's say it measures $120 trillion of gross activity is what $80 trillion is measuring. Financial system ledger is $120 trillion on the other side of that. If just half moves onto the blockchain of the financial transaction, that's a, you know, $60 trillion market. Plus, we know that as you tokenize loyalty and IP, things that are GDP measurements but not financial markets, that's also on the blockchain. So maybe the total, what ends up on the blockchain, is 60 plus 20, $80 trillion market versus your $27 trillion. That cannot fit on one ledger.
Sure. Well, and also, I mean, that's the flow side, but also you have the stock of financial assets out there, which is, you know, multiples of that. I mean, we've done it. It looks like we're going to get to $250 billion worth of financial assets, depending on how you define kind of real estate and debt against it and everything else. But, you know, by 2030, so there's a huge, as you're tokenizing those, you know, you don't recognize the full value of those assets onto the underlying chain, but it provides the utility that creates kind of like the value for the underlying chain. So,
and then there's a third element, which I know you guys talk about, which is, you know, as we try to offset wage loss from AI, we will want to have a record of taxing agentic activities to replace that lost revenue. And that's a huge accounting system that is really working on public chains. And so Yeah. So $27 trillion seems very reasonable, you know? I mean, maybe low.
Let me pose another potential, not the risk of call it technological disruption, but kind of like another, like let me lay out a scenario and what do you think of this? Because of the nature of these digital asset treasury companies, and it's the same with banks, people will be incentivized to take more risk. More risk could be, hey, instead of issuing equity, I'm going to take on debt capital in order to buy and create basically leverage stacks to try to catch up. And so is there the possibility that the game becomes dominated by the person who is taking the most amount of concealed risk on their balance sheet, such that it's kind of like the winner is a ticking time bomb of risk that once the market turns, we like all unravel?
This is the crisis question. It's the crisis question. Yeah. Again, what? Right. Yeah.
Well, I worked at JP Morgan during GFC, and Jamie Dimon was the guiding light, really the company that survived and prospered and really grew because of the GFC. And I know the first principle is a fortress balance sheet. And that's also Bitmain's view that we want to have a fortress balance sheet. So it is a straight equity company and always running cash. You know, it's, I think we've always reported every weekly update somewhere between $400 and $800 million of cash. Because of our size, you know, our liquidity and our volatility, because we have 120 vol stock, which is twice the volatility of MicroStrategy. Every bank has offered us the American Express Black Card of solutions to raise capital. And I've had zero interest in anything but the simplest and most understandable capital structure. So I think it's first principle of Bitmain to be straight and simple as possible until the moment changes. But today, debt is not appealing, or having convertible instruments is not appealing for exactly the reasons described. I don't want our capital structure to compete with equity holders in the event of a downturn.
Yeah, until the moment changes, what would that be? What would that moment be?
One thing that when we studied MicroStrategy's playbook, because they did 24 financings, mm-hmm. they embarked on a step function capital raise at some point. And a lot of that happened in the last 2 years. So if there is a chance for Bitmain to do a step function transaction, you know, to grow its concentration of ETH per share in a meaningful way that would be non-equity transaction, that could be appealing.
Step function means you would pull away from the pack so convincingly that this winner-take-all concept would not be in question at all anymore.
Yeah. So an example would be like if there was a chance, an opportunity, and this is, I'm not saying we had been looking at anything, but let's say that our ETH per share is around 50 or something, and there's a chance to grow it to 75 in one transaction. So a highly accretive transaction that is a step function raise in the concentration per share, that's appealing because that would be very good for shareholders.
So you'd be consolidating the space, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Yeah, without equity dilution. So to grow the Ethereum holdings per share. So it's not a horizontal transaction because a merger with another company, unless they were trading at a steep discount, so you could buy their at a discount. That's another way to grow concentration. But the idea is not just to be bigger in size, but it's the per share benefit rising. That's the only thing I'd be interested in without incurring or hurting future ability to raise capital or killing future volatility or burdening the company with a pure debt structure.
There is this trend of assets tokenizing. Somebody was joking the other day, wait till they tokenize the DAT. You know, you take you and you tokenize the DAT. So I'm holding a token of a corporate equity that's holding tokens. In some ways, like the utility of kind of the corporate shell is predicated on the traditional world not transferring over to being able to hold tokens directly. But there is this, you know, tailwind of, hey, you know, equity should be traded 24 hours and we should tokenize equities and stuff. How do you think about kind of like the DAT structure against that thing moving orthogonal to it, and about kind of like that tokenization and its implication for capital markets more broadly?
Well, DATs fundamentally trade off the value of the underlying. And so moving it to 24/7 is just a convenience transaction. It's not transformational because it doesn't unlock anything new. But tokenizing an NVIDIA or a Tesla is very appealing. Kathy and I have talked about this in the past, that the real value and the unlock of a tokenized NVIDIA is that we can do a factor bet. We can then see what's priced in for their Blackwell chip sales or their China sales, because now you take NVIDIA's price and you've broken it into tokenized components. And then you can use a prediction market to hedge yourself. So, Fed's replaced, or the Fed does a surprise hike. I can hedge a tokenized equity that way. The issuer has huge transparency. NVIDIA now knows what's priced in for its Blackwell chip sales, its China sales, and they can therefore work with a lot less, hey, what's priced in our stock? They know exactly what's priced in. So I think tokenized equities is a huge unlock, and it's useful for investors and for issuers. And of course, moves us away from quarterly earnings too.
Yeah, it does. Do you think the administration, that part of the talk about changing quarterly earnings and so forth, might incorporate this sort of thinking?
I would say I wouldn't be surprised, because as you know, the administration has a lot of folks tied into Silicon Valley. And we know that the prediction markets were so useful in that election. They proved themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Polymarket got 50 out of 50 states right. So I would agree, because that's probably a better way to model earnings than to wait every 90 days for a company and have the CFO tied up for a month sitting in a room, you know, auditing financials.
You know, this is music to our ears. We're all about transparency, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think this would be a really important step in making markets a lot clearer for investors and understanding what they own. It makes it less black box. And so that's why I think tokenization is a huge deal.
I also think it's kind of like when people argue, oh, you should break up the company because it'll trade, the sum of the parts will trade more than the, you know, conglomerate discount. There's a degree to which, and we've been through this with Tesla, where it's like, I think actually our work on robotaxi is not mathematically deniable. As in, if you had like a clean mechanism by which you forced people to bet on whether or not that was true, you would actually realize more of the value into the underlying equity. Because instead, people are fighting this battle of like denying common knowledge, where it's like, well, we're not going to argue you on the facts of your math, because we know we would have to concede. So we're just going to try to like pollute the information space to prevent those facts from being commonly known. And so if you like create the derivative market, you would actually allow equity markets to better discount the future. Right now, there's like this time horizon or uncertainty threshold against which they refuse. They like say, we're taking our ball and going home. And so kind of like tokenization and creation of prediction markets with better derivatives will actually allow the equity market to be more future looking than it currently is.
Yes, no question about it. This is our big battle. It would help our strategy enormously, because it would take the FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Really, a lot of that is caused by analysts, listening to the companies. You know, they followed for years and years and years, who are saying, oh, off with their heads. You know, that's our installed base. No way. And it would, getting the betting markets involved and getting more people thinking about it, just thinking about it. That's all we need, you know, would be a boon for efficiency of the market. The markets are highly inefficient right now. Highly inefficient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically, I 100% agree, because today, the equilibrium of stock price is like, we have to take everything that you guys just said and put it into a single unit of a price. But in a tokenized world, there's equilibrium for different components. And 100%, I mean, like a Tesla, an N equal one company, it's very difficult for the markets to price equilibrium, because Elon Musk is changing dynamically the future, but we're now having to price it in and based on deliveries of units sold last quarter.
Well, and it's also time horizon as well. Yeah. Right now, you know, the collapse in the time horizons to one quarter, if that, certainly in 22 and just generally because of benchmark sensitivity, has really, I think, hurt capital allocation in a big, big way.
Yes.
You know, and could hurt us competitively as a nation, especially now that China is, you know, they're not hostage to the same kinds of constraints. So, this could be amazing.
Yeah, I would love to see the U.S. embrace this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then back to Bitmine, like, I think part of the implication for Ethereum is quite positive. If these kind of like tokenized assets become really useful for issuers and market participants and for people trying to hedge risks against things that are going on in the world, you know, then kind of like the utility of tokenization and the platform that serves as the undergirding for that tokenization should become much more valuable. And so then that's, in essence, the bull case for Ethereum is kind of you're taking all of this glorious financial wealth and you are kind of like seeding it on a blockchain so that it can kind of actually allow capital formation to happen more efficiently.
And can I just ask, and I know we're getting close to the end now, but can I just ask a question that was really plaguing Ethereum for a while until its recent very dramatic turn in price? And that was, oh, you know, it's the layer twos that are collecting all the fees, the layer one is, you know, really being disadvantaged. The network activity is falling, giving way to the layer twos. So just to help people understand, I think, I mean, it was a real question when Ether was falling relative to Bitcoin dramatically, and no one wanted to bet on it, even though these institutions were basically signing on to Ethereum. To me, it was such a big disconnect. But so now we have the term, but what about that issue?
Yeah. We have to think of Ethereum as the monetary base and the standard. So let's say I'm being really theoretical, in a quote world where the L2s pay zero gas fees, okay, to the L1, mm-hmm. which is not true.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Ethereum is the monetary base would actually accrue value to it. It's the same reason someone's saying, hey, look, we trade stocks all day and it's quoted in dollars, but we don't pay the US dollar system to exist. We'd be
right,
like,
right.
The fact that NVIDIA trades in the US helps the dollar. So that's why even if there was no exchange between the two, it accrues value. But of course, we know that they're trying to fix that. And so L2s want to support L1s. And of course, in the future, any bank that is going to be building on the future of Ethereum is going to be staking Ethereum as well.
Yes. And I think the more layer twos that evolve, the more important the underlying becomes, right? So, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like staking, you stake to get the, you know, the reward from the transactions fee paid and the Ethereum burned. But there's also reservation demand, which is a separate thing. Like if Ethereum is something I have to pay for using things or, you know, it causes the end holders to need to hold it to cover off future liabilities.
Yeah.
Basically.
Imagine someone said, NVIDIA trades in America. It doesn't help the dollar. In fact, it helps the euro. We'd be like,
what?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love
all right.
it.
Well, so Tom, I'm gonna tie you to a forecast right now. So you said 27 trillion by 2030, and maybe kind of 15-20% could be in debts. That sounds a lot to me like we could have around $5 trillion worth of equity capital in digital asset treasury companies in the 2030 timeframe.
I think that's right. I believe MicroStrategy will be one of the largest companies in America because of its Bitcoin holdings. So it's about 100 billion market cap today, 15 billion of debt, so 115. If Bitcoin goes to 2 million, then that's going to be a $2 trillion company. And it's because of its holding of Bitcoin, no different than an oil company. I think Ethereum can reach 60,000 per token in that world. And that would proportionally benefit the DATs because Ethereum's around 4,500 today. So a 15 times increase plus the NAV expansion. So there would be a lot of upside in the existing Ethereum treasury stocks in that world, and many would become multiple hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap.
Well, this sounds like an optimistic future.
Yes. Well, we look forward to you doing your part to make it happen. And we do think that, I mean, it really is a remarkable moment in capital markets and technological economic history. I mean, I think we're privileged to live in this particular age at this particular time. So thanks for kind of like guiding for the future in your slice.
And I think that, you know, your expertise in TradFi and, you know, really broad perspective is really important in terms of, you know, helping people, investors and others, migrate into this new world. As we always say at ARK, you know, it's really important to get on the right side of change. And so I think you're a guiding light, Tom. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was a great conversation.
Great.
Thank you
for joining FYI, the Four-Year Innovation Podcast. I'm Brett Winton. This is Kathy Wood. This is Tom Lee. Thanks so much for joining, Tom. Please rate and review us on the podcasting platform of your choice. 5-star ratings only. If you're going to rate us 1-star, don't bother to grade us. Yeah.
You shouldn't have to say it. You shouldn't have to say it, Brett.
Okay. Enjoy your week.
Okay. Thanks so much.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.